Mr. Speaker, this is a devastating day for Australia. The COVID-19 global recession and pandemic that has impacted the world has impacted Australia. Australians know that's the case, Mr. Speaker.
I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
Australia is in recession, and it's the most severe one on record. When people followed orders to stay at home in April, May and June, they also went on a spending strike. The economy shrank by 7%, a dramatic decline much worse than the dip at the start of the year.
In September, Australia entered a recession for the first time in 30 years.
Australians know, Mr. Speaker, that many, many months ago, that this day would come. And this day has come.
As countries around the world face similar economic woes, some are questioning how governments run their economies and are calling for a new way to think about politics, economics, and public well-being. This concept, known as modern monetary theory, has been championed by some economists for decades, but now it's finding a new generation of supporters and critics. Today, what is modern monetary theory, and could it fix Australia's problems? It's Thursday, the 19th of November. Martin, I want to start with the idea of debt. We've heard for so many years that debt is a bad thing. Where does this idea come from?
Well, I think that's really from the post-war years when the sort of economics world was captured by a group of economists in Chicago.
Martin Farah is an editor for The Guardian and an economics reporter.
They were known as the Chicago School, and they were led by a guy called Milton Friedman.
You're paying for it indirectly in the form of inflation or in the form of borrowing. The thing you should keep your eye on is what government spends. And the real problem is to hold down government spending as a fraction of our income. And if you do
He said basically the job of government was to cut spending, to reduce the deficit, and let the private sector get on with it. That was adopted by a lot of governments after the massive sort of economic crises of the 70s, the late 60s and the early 70s, the oil shock, etc. And it became the kind of consensus.
You can do so only by borrowing your savings or by taxing you more. And it's no good thinking that someone else will pay. That someone else is you.
Mrs. Thatcher in Britain was the classic example of it.
There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money.
You know, because she was a woman, I think it helped that she presented it as a sort of, she was the housewife who was going to come along and sort of, you know, straighten out all these stupid blokes who'd wrecked the economy by saying, you know, we've got to balance the books and we're going to cut spending and all this sort of stuff.
But what the honourable member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. That way you will never create the wealth for better social services as we have. And what a policy! Yes, he would rather have the poor poorer.
And at the same time, Ronald Reagan came to power in America.
Let me just give a few attention getters from the audience. The federal budget is out of control. And we face runaway deficits of almost $80 billion for this budget year. That deficit is larger than the entire federal budget in 1957. And so is the almost $80 billion we will pay in interest this year.
And it became the kind of accepted idea that you had to balance the books.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. It is time to reawaken this industry.
You were a child of Thatcher's Britain, weren't you, Martin?
I was, yeah.
I wonder if you can tell us what it felt like to you as a child at the time.
Well, when she came to power, I was 13 in 1979, and I remember being quite a sort of, and into the early 80s, I remember being fascinated by politics, and I was There is such anger about it because she slashed public spending. She slashed a lot of welfare spending. And she took the axe to a lot of industry. And I grew up in the northeast of England, which was a very industrialised part of the country. There was a lot of unemployment. She saw unemployment as a sort of acceptable price to pay for, you know, balancing the books, as she would have said, and ridding the nation of the scourge of inflation. That's what she used to talk about. But it was an incredibly tough time. I mean, there was 4 million people unemployed in Britain in the early 80s, and I was just about to leave school. So everyone was kind of terrified of not being able to find a job. So it was a very bitter time, I think, and a lot of traditional communities were kind of lost forever. You know, they were kind of destroyed, which I think is, you know, it was the worst thing about it.
And did it work? Did this cutting of public spending boost the economy in Thatcher's England and Reagan's USA?
Well, they talked a good game about cutting spending, but neither of them really did it in the end. They did cut taxes, but they didn't cut spending. What's interesting is that both under Thatcher and Reagan, spending went through the roof, really. Debt kept going up. I mean, especially in the US, the national debt in the US really took off in those years.
So what were they spending the money on?
Defence, in their case, is quite markedly. I remember the Falklands War in Britain was a hugely expensive operation, and at a time when Thatcher was cutting all sorts of things in Britain. And Reagan was spending a lot of money on Star Wars and that sort of space age weapons defence system. Incredible expenditure. And that sort of gets forgotten about, really, because they're seen as champions of that sort of economics.
Mm. And all of what you're describing, is this what we today call neoliberalism?
Yeah, that's what it's become. It's developed into more than just economics. And I think it's become a kind of political theory, an all-encompassing theory. But the original monetary theory, as it was known, is really like the economic wing of neoliberalism. But despite conservatives banging the drum for this sort of neoliberal approach since the 80s, we've had massive national debt again and again in Western countries, and the sky hasn't fallen in. I think one of the big turning points that has hammered home the underlying mechanisms behind modern monetary theory was the global financial crisis.
So this is where, in some sense, the crisis began.
Yeah, this was the place where people were stumbling out of offices on the 15th of September 2008, the world having ended.
This was the time a decade ago when the financial crisis erupted, a crash that most experts did not foresee. Its effects and of the recession that followed on income, wealth, inequality, and our politics are still with us.
You mentioned the global financial crisis. Can you just give our younger listeners a bit of a refresher on what actually happened there?
In 2008, the global financial system very nearly collapsed. It was the result of banks all over the world, but especially in the US, lending far too much money to people who couldn't afford to pay it back, basically. And it was the result of years of lax regulation, low interest rates. And it basically meant that there was too much debt. And that came back to bite the banks in the end. People basically started wanting their money back. So Lehman Brothers, which is a huge investment bank in the US where people were paid millions of dollars working there, they started to run out of money because people were coming to them and saying, look, you know, this investment we made, we'd like this money back because we don't think it's worth as much as it was. So they just basically ran out of money, and all the banks started running out of money. Lehman Brothers collapsed in September 2008, and it caused a huge panic throughout the world. And they only really steadied the ship when the US Federal Reserve basically pumped billions and billions of dollars into the system to sort of shore it up.
So come to the global financial crisis, and most governments around the world increased deficits.
Bill Mitchell is a professor of economics and the director of the Centre for Full Employment and Equity at the University of Newcastle. He's one of the world's leading proponents on modern monetary theory.
central banks started to buy large volumes of government debt, Bank of England, European Central Bank, Federal Reserve Bank in America. And the economists were out there in force predicting rising bond yields, rising inflation, insolvency for governments, and we saw exactly the opposite. So, you know, we've reached a situation where even though we've had large and continuous deficits, we've had large volumes of central bank buying government debt, all of the aggregates have moved exactly in the opposite direction to the way in which mainstream economics predicted. And more influential parties are starting to observe that.
So, Martin, is what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that the financial crisis showed that governments can actually whip out millions or even billions of dollars out of their back pockets to stimulate the economy if they want to?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's it was a kind of emperor's new clothes sort of moment in a way, that there was the world economy was on its knees in 2008, and lo and behold, the governments found not just billions of dollars, but they found trillions of dollars to kickstart the economy, basically to flood the financial system with cash, and that has kind of floated the global economy ever since. So governments did have a way of producing money, essentially printing money, which is the basis of MMT.
So that's what modern monetary theory is, just governments printing money?
Yeah, in its simplest form, that's what it is. But provided the country has its own currency, so Australia, the UK, the US, for example, all have their own currency, so you can create the money. Now, money doesn't have to be paid back to anyone. It's just created by the central bank, which is really, you know, a sort of arm of the government anyway. And that money it's added to the national debt, but it doesn't have to be paid back. You know, no one really pays back the national debt.
The Japanese government, the Australian government, the US government, British government, most nearly all governments, they can purchase whatever is for sale in their own currency whenever they choose. And the only constraints on government spending are not the financial constraints of how's it going to pay for it or where's it going to get the money from. The only constraints are the availability of real resources that it can bring into productive use.
So does this mean that governments can spend as much as they want without limit?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. And that's the critics then say, oh, modern monetary theory is about magic money tree. You know, they're saying the government has no limits. Well, the government has limits. And if the government tries to spend beyond the capacity of the economy to meet that spending with real production, well, then you'll cause inflation. So the constraint there is a real constraint.
Modern monetary theory doesn't say that you can endlessly flood the economy with money. You have to sort of match it to the resources available, which is inflation, basically.
And what is inflation?
Well, inflation is basically a mismatch between demand and supply. So if you've got too much money chasing too few goods, so too much demand and not enough supply, the price of the goods is going to go up because the seller of those goods can charge whatever they want. So that, in a crude way, that is what causes inflation. If there's too much demand and not enough supply, it's like our old favourite subject, Australian house prices. You would say that, you know, if there's not enough houses, then people will bid up the price of the ones that are available.
So how does inflation interact or influence MMT?
Well, yeah, critics of MMT would say that the obvious problem with it is that if you flood an economy with money, then you're going to create inflation because then there'll be an artificially high amount of money and demand and not enough supply to keep pace with it. So what the theorists would say to that is that they would watch inflation very carefully, and that when inflation starts to rise too quickly, then they would increase taxes, for example, to take the edge off demand and to rebalance the economy.
And you mentioned runaway inflation, or I think it's sometimes called hyperinflation. Is that what happened in Zimbabwe in the early 2000s?
Well, in Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe gave a lot of the farmland to the soldiers who'd fought with him in the independence war. So there then became a problem with supply from the agricultural sector. And at the same time, the manufacturing sector malfunctioned, and you had a kind of breakdown of both the major sectors of the economy, which just sent inflation rocketing. And in Germany in the 20s was the other classic example of hyperinflation, where people were carting their wages back in wheelbarrows and all that sort of stuff. And that was really just because the whole economy sort of collapsed. There was a chronic lack of demand and a chronic collapse in supply. The whole country just sort of malfunctioned, and hyperinflation was the result of that. But I think that what MMT theorists would say is that we don't have that situation now. We've got perfectly well-functioning manufacturing capacity in most countries, and you wouldn't have that collapse of demand and supply. So you can afford to build up the deficit. You can afford to create more money without the risk of inflation, because there's so much spare capacity still in the economies.
Okay, so just a bit of a recap. So hyperinflation is bad, and it leads to things like destabilized currency. So you don't want to go too far into flooding your economy with money. But it's a marker, is it, for MMT theorists as to how much money you should print?
Exactly. It's a marker for how healthy the economy is. So that if inflation's rising a bit, then MMT would say, well, that's good, because it's probably brought people out of unemployment, and therefore it's balanced the economy. The other marker that's important is this idea of unemployment, and that's where if you've got too much spare capacity in economies, you've got people who are unemployed. But one of the goals of MMT is full employment.
Full employment. What you're saying is the 5 to 6% unemployment rate that we think is good actually could be much better?
Yeah, I think unemployment at that sort of level is the price that neoliberals would probably be prepared to pay to balance the books. And I think that's shown in a lot of countries where we've got that sort of level of unemployment and no one really does anything to try and bring that down. But MMT would say it's possible for everyone who wants to have a job to have a job. You just have to, you know, create more demand in the economy.
And if the private sector can't create enough jobs and the career aspect of the public service can't create enough jobs, well, then the government can create as many jobs as it wants.
Governments would employ more people when the economy is not doing so well, for example, and employ less people in a boom period. And that's how MMT would work, you know, with a bit more government intervention as well.
The period after the Second World War, we had full employment, which was below 2% unemployment. It was the fact that most governments ran a very small buffer of jobs. In Australia, it was in transport sector, the railways, in the big infrastructure departments, housing, roads, in local government. You could always get a job anytime you wanted in one of those areas. And that was just a political choice of governments to use its capacity to do that. I'm surprised that people think it's an ambition beyond us.
So would you say then that the aim of modern monetary theory is to create more equality?
I think that's definitely what it's about. I think that's one of the driving sort of philosophical kind of forces of it. At the minute, the balance in the world economy is so much on the side of capital, i.e. private businesses, companies, and not in the hands of the labour force. So MMT is about shifting the balance back so that the labour force has more power in the economy. And it's about creating that balance that we've not really had in a lot of Western economies for decades.
Next, MMT in a post-COVID world. You mentioned the global financial crisis earlier and the coronavirus crisis and how these are changing the way we think about economies and budgets. What has changed? What has that made us reassess?
Right, I think this is the crucial thing. When Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, that was an epochal moment. But I think that the policy response to that, which was basically to flood the financial system with newly created money in the process known as quantitative easing, that's basically where the central bank buys government bonds, and that money is then delivered into the financial system, and the central banks hold the government debt. I mean, anyone can buy government debt, but in this situation, the central bank creates the money to buy those bonds, and that money is then pumped into the system. And it's that process during the GFC that's really changed the way we can think about the economy.
Mm.
It was basically a money creation scheme, and they pumped billions and billions and billions of dollars into the system. And hey presto, there hasn't been runaway hyperinflation since then. In fact, it's very much the opposite. The inflation has flatlined ever since then. So I think that's a key moment in reassessing where we are with this, because although quantitative easing was not really MMT as such, but in some ways it was in all but name, it was MMT. You know, you could argue that we're sort of living with MMT now, because, you know, they turned on the printing presses to save the banking system, and they were prepared to do it to save the banks.
But they're not prepared to do it to create full employment.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the way that the left could frame the whole argument, really, in that why not? He did it for the big end of town, so why not do it for, you know, to get people moving again, you know, try and create jobs in communities where those sort of good working class jobs in industries and stuff have gone.
In Australia, after the global financial crisis, we didn't have quantitative easing in the same way as Europe and America, but Kevin Rudd's government did send checks to everyone.
Yeah.
How does that fit into MMT?
Well, I think that what you can see in Australia, that was just the beginning of a long sort of easing of monetary policy. Rudd very cleverly sort of identified that as a good way to sort of prime the economy quickly, basically just putting money into people's hands. And it worked, didn't it? They spent a lot of the money. So in Australia, I think, you know, at that time, interest rates were about 5% or something around that the time of the financial crisis. But ever since then, they've come down, and now they're virtually zero. As Australia has kind of got into step, if you like, with the other world economies. So the US economy, where interest rates are very low, the UK, Japan, where they've been ultra low for about 30 years.
Mm.
But I think Australia has kind of didn't have quantitative easing, but the financial crisis, the impact of that was to level the board all around the world. And you know, Australia is now feeling the effect of that, in that it has to sort of be in step with other economies. They're so closely linked. And now the RBA has really started QE here in the last year or so. It's just as a way of kind of keeping the economy going. I mean, it's a kind of crazy situation, but that is what's happening here. You've got a government that's trying to put the economy into surplus. Meanwhile, the Reserve Bank is just giving money away.
Martin, we've heard for years under the Liberal government about how important a budget surplus is, which obviously now has just been thrown out the window with the coronavirus. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned before about the aim of MMT is a balanced economy, because this isn't something we hear from political leaders at all. We hear about a balanced budget.
Yeah.
Is there a difference?
Well, yes, I think they are. I mean, I think the bean counters in the federal government, you know, are obsessed with this surplus here. I mean, it's gone to the winds now, but before the coronavirus crisis, that's all we ever heard about was Josh Frydenberg and his blasted surplus. But it doesn't matter about that if you've got a million people still idle and not working. That, surely it's more important to have those people working and to doing something useful for society and for themselves than balancing the precious budget.
Mm.
So I think that's the balance, is that the balance has to go more towards satisfying everyone's needs, if you like, you know, giving people a job, giving them a home, giving them decent services. And if that means you have to put the budget into deficit, then so what?
It's almost about values as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And maybe that's a good segue into talking about well-being. Is it the government's responsibility to care about the well-being of its citizens?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I think yes, but I want you to say the answer.
The government is us. It's our agent.
Mm.
And, you know, the capitalist system is prone to crises. And if the capital system is left unfettered, then it will pursue greed and environmental disasters. And so what we want governments to do is to countervail that propensity of capitalism to create chaos, which undermines our prosperity. And so the only our agent, the government, we're relying on it to ensure that we've got jobs, that our wages are growing in line with productivity, which they're not, haven't for the last 25 years. That's what our agent should be doing. It's not doing that.
That's, again, that we've come to the back to the crux about it, in that people like Margaret Thatcher would have said, well, it's not really the government's responsibility to worry about the well-being of people. You just create certain conditions and people can kind of make of that what they will. And if some people don't make the grade, then that's bad luck on them. But I think MMT is challenging that, isn't it? It's kind of saying that that's all wrong. We're leaving too many people behind. And the kind of social problems that you get if you disregard the well-being of a large chunk of society, it's not worth it, is it? It's too big a cost. And I think that in some ways you could say the virus crisis is a little window into how that might look in the future, because governments now are all about looking after people's well-being. It's become the raison d'etre of governments, hasn't it?
Kind of proving that it could be done when they said it couldn't, but also that recognising a need to care for people in a crisis is the government's role after all.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's a very visible crisis and you can see the numbers every day. You can't resist that number, can you? You can't argue against that number coming up on the TV every day. Everyone can see it. It's like a sort of, it's like a scorecard, without wishing to sound so sort of brutal about it. And that has forced governments to respond in an unusual way, hasn't it? But as you say, the crisis for years, the coalition going on about balancing the books. But as soon as the crisis hit, they suddenly found all this money and were able to create a budget deficit. And look, you know, we're still here. You know, we're still surviving.
Yeah.
The mainstream paradigm serves the vested interests. Because, you know, nobody says anything when the government puts out $1 trillion to bail out the bankers. But as soon as they say, oh, we'll put out $1 trillion to help the lowest paid and most disadvantaged, oh, we can't afford that, you know. So everybody's known forever that they've got the capacity. It's just to build up this fictional narrative that they haven't has created a smokescreen which serves the interests of the top end of town.
It seems obvious, right, to you and me, you just said this, that people would, that the government's caring for the people and making sure people had what they needed would be like a pretty popular idea. But why don't people seem to vote for these kinds of policies?
Yeah, that's a tough question, Gav. I don't think I've got time to answer that.
Yeah, I know it's very hard.
Yeah, why? Because I think I guess there's lots of factors, and I think we've created in the last 40 or 50 years in the Western world, we've created a kind of idea that it's every person for themselves, and you know, if you could trample on someone else to get to the top, then that's a perfectly acceptable thing to do.
Mm.
I think that's where we've sort of gone wrong. without wishing to make it too sort of too existential a sort of answer to your question, but I think that you've got to see that that's the case, really. I think that people are out for themselves more, they were, until the crisis started. So maybe it will reset the way people think about things.
That's it for today. Thanks to Martin Farah and Bill Mitchell for their time. This episode was produced by Hannah Izzard, Ellen Leibeater and Joe Koning. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me. Thanks for listening. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you tomorrow.